So tonight is our third class on Act of Hope, this book by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. So if you have not been here for the previous two classes and you're interested, they have been recorded. And if you go to our website, I believe it's like resources, and then it's audio, and there's Dharma talks, and there's classes, and this would be under classes. And yeah, so you can listen to what was said before. Tonight we are covering chapter four, which is honoring our pain for the world. And just hand these out. If you've seen them before, you don't need to take one, but whatever. I'll cover those in a moment. So it's been helpful to me to be working on this class, I mean this whole series. This is the relationship between practice and my concern for the world, for the beings in the world, has been, you know, it's been central to my life and practice all along. And at times it's been a bit of a struggle to see how practice, especially our practice together as Sangha, matches up with this. I think what I'm hoping to tap into is about our heart's deepest aspirations. It's about the Bodhisattva vow to free all beings. So in some ways, I find it helpful rather than to look at Buddhism and think, okay, well, what does it have to say on helping others, or, you know, working in change for the world, or social justice, or environmental responsibility, or anything like that, to actually kind of start more with, like, what does my heart tell me that I should be doing? What does my heart wish for? What does my conscience say? So kind of starting with that experience, and then saying, you know, how can practice support me in that exploration? So my goal is starting to clarify is to encourage us to ask ourselves, am I doing all I can? That question requires courage. And that question, I'm seeing more and more, requires support from our practice, from our Sangha, from our friends, in asking ourselves that question. And we're going to talk tonight a little bit about why that is. We often avoid asking because of a sense of overwhelm or powerlessness, guilt, shame, sorrow. And if we have the courage to ask ourselves that, am I doing all I can? Maybe our answer is, yes, I'm doing all I can. Which, you know, that's one answer. But I think for many of us, there is an answer like, no, I don't feel like I'm doing all I can, or at least all I want to. But many of us don't know what to do with that. What's next? How do we go forward with that without succumbing to despair or overwhelm or whatever? How do we find a meaningful response that accords with our heart, that we feel like it matters, and how do we support one another in that response? So Macy and Johnstone, and I agree with them, and I think there's many people in this world that have found a way to navigate this. And they say it is possible. It's possible to find a way to act assigned some action to take that allows us to focus on active hope rather than our despairing estimation of the likelihood of success. So that was the definition of active hope, is what do we hope for in this world, and then that is where we concentrate on working for that, without it being so much of like, do I hope that, you know, this will really make a difference? Do I hope that we will rescue ourselves? Our responses to all of this, are we doing enough? What should we do? Are our own responses. So I see this as being very analogous to precept practice, where we share a common aspiration to not kill, not steal, to not indulge anger, to not be stingy, and all of the positive aspects of that. But we trust one another to do our own practice in that regard. We trust one another to explore that and to do our best. So I encourage us, as we explore, to let go of comparing ourselves to each other, comparing ourselves to who we wish we could be or what we could do, judging mind of ourselves or others. That's just kind of, you know, none of that is really necessary. This is going to be about us guessing that question and exploring what kind of response we can find. So just briefly, so my four basic premises, I'll just cover again, is just that, could you hand me one of those? I forgot to keep one. So basically, I'm not going to try to convince you that we're in a climate or ecological emergency. If you need convincing, I can talk to you later. But you know, that's kind of a basic premise that I'm starting with. Trying to shift the conversation away from green consumerism. I mean, I acknowledge those choices matter a lot, especially our diet. But a lot of times we end up getting stuck there and we don't go any farther, because then it just becomes a debate about our individual action. And then we overlook the more systemic, larger issues that are actually behind a lot of this. The third is that our spiritual practice compels us to act for the welfare of all beings, and such action is inseparable from our spiritual practice in good ways and a sense of responsibility. So it's not just morally we're obligated to do this, but that actually wrestling with this, finding our way, can be spiritual practice. It can be rewarding spiritual practice. It can teach us about ourselves and letting go of self and compassion and all those things. And also in our efforts to bring about a life-sustaining society, the time has come for solidarity and inclusion, and there's a place for everyone in what Joanna Macy calls the Great Turning. So I kind of already said a little bit about this, but just, you know, this is for each of us to do our own practice and not to compare with each other. Okay, so tonight, I said we're moving on to honoring our pain for the world. So Macy and Johnstone present a four-part, they call it a spiral. So there's these, and on my podcast, I called it the fourfold path of active hope, because it's kind of like the eightfold path, in that each of these are aspects. It's not you do one after the other. They all need to be involved. So they talk about coming from gratitude, which we talked about last time. And I see this as actually in the context of our practice, all the ways that we sustain ourselves and try to find joy in life and maintain sanity and connection. So that's the kind of regenerative stuff that we do to in order to have the strength and resilience to do this work. Now, then the second one is honoring our pain for the world, which we'll talk about tonight, and then seeing with new eyes, and then going forth. So they say we go around this spiral repeatedly, and each time it's a little different. So obviously, if we want to respond as bodhisattvas to the suffering in the world, we have to face the suffering in the world, and that, if unless we are shutting ourselves down, is bound to be painful. This is the bummer class, you know. Last week was gratitude, that was special, and then we're going to see with new eyes, and, you know, she has several chapters on seeing with new eyes and going forth, and but this is like, all right, I'm going to honor our pain for the world. Now, it's tricky to go here, because a few of you might recall, a few years ago, we had a workshop here that was associated with Joanna Macy's The Work That Reconnects. Do you guys remember that? Mm-hmm. And it was just a few hours, and I guess in retrospect, that's just really not enough time. That's like, so we did some of these, you know, workshop-y exercises, and where we kind of, you know, brought up some of this pain and suffering and sadness and stuff, but then we did then we went home. It's like it felt almost a little irresponsible to do that, to just so if you are particularly intrigued by this book, just be aware that Joanna Macy and they do workshops around this whole thing. They do, if you ever were interested in exploring it more deeply, you could go for a couple of days and you could go through this whole process, and it sounds like it's great. You know, in our setting, I think I'm inclined to go to about a little bit more of a Zen way, which is a little less intense. It's a little less like, let's all have a catharsis tonight. And weep, and, you know, get in contact with our despair, and then, you know, because it's like, you know, then what do? Then you go home. Then maybe you're just depressed. I don't know. It's our way is to be a little more, just kind of keep an eye on things, to invite, to even start asking this question, how do I honor my pain for the world? Just even that just kind of suggests that there is a place for it, that it is something that we can face, something we can handle. I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but some of the ways that we do this is like the wall behind Kanseon. Invite people to bring in images that remind them of instances of suffering in the world that we want to think of with a compassionate heart. We have a dedication of merit that we chant at the end of our chanting service on Sunday, where, you know, we say, who knows what this really means, but if there's any merit to what we're doing, we dedicate it to those who are suffering, those who are sick, or those who have passed away, and we list names. And for me, I don't know or necessarily believe that has any like actual impact, but I know it has an impact on us. It feels right. It feels right to be here and to turn our minds and hearts toward those who are suffering. So those are the kind of things where we're trying to make our Zen center a place of refuge, but not by shutting things out. So sometimes we will mention things. We will mention, you know, there's like a week ago or so, there was a demonstration at the ICE facility protesting the incarceration of migrant children, and things like that, that will bring in, so some of that suffering is brought into the Zendo. But it's supposed to be a place of refuge in that we're invited to bring our honest feelings and reactions and try to support one another in applying our practice to our actual lives and exploring a path of hope and determination together. So I think of it, it's our response together that makes this a place of refuge. Because outside, as I think many of you know, discussions about these kinds of things aren't usually very fruitful or rewarding. You'd have to be a pretty rare friend that you can have a really like meaningful, thoughtful conversation about. Usually either it just comes into like a debate where like now we're repeating stuff that we're not really all that informed about and trying to, you know, make our point. Or we're just talking with people who agree with us and then we're just kind of bitching about the other people who are to blame, or I don't know. So a lot of times that those conversations aren't very fruitful in the outside world. So hopefully we can have them with each other and have them be a little bit more, well, for one thing, it tends to be more inwardly focused, not in the sense of excluding the outside, but in what is my response to this? How am I feeling about it? What do I really know about it? What am I called to do? Etc. And we also practice and try to cultivate don't know mind. That we don't have to have all the answers. That simply showing up and paying attention and doing our best is a good thing. We don't necessarily, you know, it's an illusion anyway that we thought we had all the answers. And having this faith that we can find a way to live that's more in accord with our heart's deepest aspirations, one that is more authentic, intimate, and engaged. And to me, this is really what practice is about in a more general sense. Sure, there's Buddhist teachings and practices, traditional Buddhist teachings and practices, but I feel like the essence of the Buddhist message is we can do something about our experience. We have choices. We have choices in the way that we think about things, in the way that we behave. We have choices that can lead to greater ease of mind, to lead to greater liberation, compassion, and wisdom. It may not immediately be obvious what those choices are, and we may not be able to make them even right away as soon as we recognize what they are, but it is possible. So just to cover what Macy and Johnstone say about the importance of honoring our pain for the world. So they say this is an important, they point out how many people are struggling with pain for the world. It's something that we will often just distract ourselves from or suppress or deny or whatever, because well, there's a whole list of reasons. So Chris Johnstone is a specialist in the psychology of resilience, happiness, and positive change. And they were sharing a story of an experiment where they had people in an experimental situation, and they were filling out a questionnaire, which I'm sure the questionnaire didn't actually have anything to do with the experiment, but the participants probably thought they did. So they're in a room with other people, and they're filling out this questionnaire, and like vapor starts to come through under the door, like it's smoke. And if people were filling out the questionnaire by themselves, they would very quickly, like, you know, go see what was up or call the experimenter or something. Like, clearly there's something awry here. But if it was a room full of people, they would look around, and if other people just kept on filling in their questionnaire, they were much more likely to just fill in their questionnaire, because it looks to me like there's something wrong, but everybody else seems to think there's nothing wrong, so, you know. And I think admitting you know, we can think, oh, that's silly, I wouldn't do that, but this is human nature, you know, this is how we are. And this is describing a lot of what happens in the world when something awful is happening and we find out about it and we go, like, you know, we go to a friend or we go to a spouse or something, like, do you know that this thing is happening? And then people are like, I mean, it's hard to maintain that sense of urgency when everybody else is, you know, shrugging. So they list 7 reasons why they say our natural response, our sense of like, uh-oh, you know, there's something wrong, we've got to do something, why it gets blocked. And one, I don't believe it's that dangerous. So this is helped by, you know, our social responses, but they also point out how our sources of information, you know, the news, are corporate, and they want to keep us interested, but not too concerned. They want us to keep buying stuff and, you know, continue with business as usual, so I don't want us to get too upset. So in a way, the news is helping with the whole process of figuring, well, it can't be that big a deal, because, you know, it's not in the headlines every day. 2 is, it isn't my role to sort this out. 3, I don't want to stand out from the crowd. And this is an awkward one. This is like, if we really believe, which I certainly have at times, it's like there will be this moment of kind of realization or panic, like, oh my God, you know, this is a dire situation. And yet, you know, I'm just a bummer to my friends and family. I mean, nobody wants to hear about it. Or, you know, if I was to go out and do something dramatic about it, people would just think that was weird, or you're emotional, or you're overwrought, or frankly, you're mentally ill. Like, that's what a lot of people who have gotten very upset about this, they go to therapy, and the therapist's just like, well, I think we need to, you know, examine what kind of trauma you've had in the past, or so then, you know, again, it's turned toward the individual. It can't possibly be reflecting reality out there. This information threatens my commercial or political interests. So, of course, they talk about the tobacco industry, where, you know, for so long there were people trying to point out how smoking was harmful to your health, but those who were speaking up were just constantly discredited and sidelined. And also a Thai meteorologist who warned of tsunami danger in the 1990s, and he was advocating for better warning systems and avoiding building so much in critical zones and all this kind of stuff. And he was sidelined in his profession, and he was even banned from going into some of the provinces that he was trying to warn. That's how completely they tried to shut him down. And then in 2004, 230,000 people were killed in a tsunami.
What would be the reason for them? I can understand the corporate and stuff, and like, but what would be the benefit of ignoring
him?
Yeah, the tsunami.
You know, developers. It was like vacation land. It was, it was like developing these, but, you know, either where you lived or you vacationed in these beautiful areas close to the water, and so those first 4 are kind of like business as usual reactions. These next 3 are a little different. It's so upsetting, I prefer not to think about it. You know, it's just too much, and I just have to just go on a news diet or something. 6, I feel paralyzed. I'm aware of the danger, but just I don't know what to do. Or 7, there's no point in doing anything, since it won't make any difference. So they said these are these are where these our responses get blocked. You know, this is many different explanations for the phenomenon we see where we just, I just go about my life as if it isn't happening.
Doga?
Yeah.
Today, apparently, a bunch of people super glued themselves in the Capitol building to make people aware of the climate crisis. I mean, it's getting.
With our cap, like DC?
Yes, in DC, super glued because this is an emergency. Some people are getting desperate to do it. So.
Yeah.
But it won't make any difference.
which response are we feeling? Probably many of them. We cycle through them.
Why super glue?
What?
Why super glue? Why that particular type?
Well, I guess like people change themselves. It's just sort of like change. It's just super
glue. It's some kind of glue, and then it's really hard for the cops to get you off.
Wow.
So it just slows down. It slows down the process of you being removed. So they say it's difficult even to talk about this. There are taboos in normal conversation that block the discussion of anything considered too depressing. When we feel dread about what might lie ahead, outrage at what is happening to our planet, or sadness about what has already been lost, it is likely that we have nowhere to take these feelings. As a result, we tend to keep them to ourselves and suffer in isolation. If people see us keeping quiet, not mentioning the crisis, then just like in the smoke-filled room, they'll be more likely to keep their mouths shut as well. If we reveal our distress and name the horrors we see, we're likely to be called overly negative or too emotional. We can be caught between two fears, the fear of what will happen if we as a society continue the way we're going, and the fear of acknowledging how bad things are because of the despair that this brings up. If we listen to the first fear, it can provoke responses that aid our survival. But to benefit from this wake-up call, we need to free ourselves from the stifling effect of the second fear. And there are ways to do this. So the fear of the despair that this will bring up. So this is what I find so encouraging and hopeful about what they present in this book is encouraging us to find a way to face that and be real with it. And it's kind of, you know, it's like other aspects of practice where, you know, if somebody didn't tell me, if you do this, if you sit on the cushion and don't do anything and you do silence and you do these things, you know, things will get better, you know, and you might be able to do this thing or that thing. I mean, I had to be told that. I wouldn't have thought to do this myself, to do this practice. So in a way, I feel like, you know, I they're telling us there is a way. So stay tuned. I really like this short passage of theirs. As with grief work, facing our distress doesn't make it disappear. Instead, when we do face it, we are able to place our distress within a larger landscape that gives it a different meaning. Rather than feeling afraid of our pain for the world, we learn to be strengthened by it. So they describe pain as a normal feedback loop to help us navigate the world, right? Ooh, too close to the flame. Ooh, it's too cold out here. I need to put a coat on. So the pain that we're feeling is to help us navigate the right way to live. So if we're trying to avoid the pain, to numb it out or distract ourselves from it, then we're shutting down this natural healthy response to the world. And also, if we think of it that way, it just feels less pathological. And they also say, I mean, not that, like I said, not that we're going to do her workshop exercises or whatever, but It's like, even in that context, it's, you might think it's a bottomless well, but it's not. That at a certain point, it moves through, and people usually feel a little more free to act. Oh, and when we touch into our depths, we find that the pit is not bottomless. When people are able to tell the truth about what they know, see, and feel is happening to their world, a transformation occurs. There is an increased determination to act and a renewed appetite for life. A range of factors acts together to bring about this shift. First, as noted, repressing emotions and information dampens our energy. It is enlivening to go with rather than against the flow of our deep felt responses to the world. Second, we feel tremendous relief on realizing our solidarity with others. So that is one of the things that, I think could be a point of real hope for our world as we look around, at least in our society, and how fractured we are from each other, how isolated we are. And this, it may be an emergency in a sense but that causes us to have to do this, but we'll have to reach out to one another more. Ruth Ann, yeah.
I think one way of deepening it is a good way to get away from the us and them and the narrower thinking. This morning in a workshop on home, it was a writing workshop, one of the participants said she heard on the news that one of the guards on the border that takes care of children in cages said he felt like a robot. And her comment was in this group that if you feel like a robot, he said that, he was, he's just following orders, he didn't feel human in his full sense. So when I heard that, I thought, well, that means in a sense he felt like an outsider in the bigger picture. And so I had compassion for, not just the hunted, but the hunter, and in the wider part of honoring pain. And when I heard on the news a few days ago that border people, regardless of what their hierarchy is in the system, they all said the system is broken. And some of them said, well, that was their justification for doing all kinds of things. But it made me have some compassion for the wider picture rather than just the immediate so-called victims. And I think that's one thing the practice, our practice, can kind of allow us to have a wider landscape. Not that we're fixing, but just to hold them in our space.
Well, and it's we can learn to be more skillful with all of this, in the sense that I don't know, I'm guessing other people relate to this, that when there's something that I am concerned about, like this situation, it's very difficult to start talking to people about it or addressing it without it immediately kind of devolving into it's Democrats versus Republicans, or we should do this, or we can't have open borders, and it's like it immediately devolves into like the details and the difficulties and the challenges, when it's like, wait a second, everybody knows there's something wrong here, like let's take a deep breath and recognize that, and that the fact that we can't see an immediate solution, which isn't our job to do anyway, does not devalue or invalidate our heart response. So in a way, we need to stay a little more centered in that heart response. Like, I am very deeply distressed about this situation. We have to believe there's a way to fix these things. We have to just saying, well, it's difficult, it's complicated, it's expensive. No, that's not good enough. Yeah, and actually, that's right. This next thing I was going to say, acknowledging that our concern at that level is not political. Our concern at that level, I mean, you can call it moral, or you can call it just human, or our sense of conscience, or our sense of connection. That's where we need to operate from, and not get too lost in the details. They said there was two things. In terms of kind of absorbing the painful information, they said one of the exercises that they do in these workshops, and that, you know, if you have this book, you could do on your own, the kind of open-ended sentences. When I think about the condition of our world, I would say things are getting. Some concerns I have include. Some feelings that come up when I think about these are. So kind of exploring that, our inner experience of that. And they say, to address the challenges we face, we need to develop ways of talking about them that don't become battles about who is to blame, or an avoidance mechanism that filters out the true depths of our concern. Because in a way, leaping immediately to that problem solving, which most of us are completely ill-equipped for anyway, it can be a way to back away from the difficulty of the feeling, the difficulty of the reality of it. If we just get into a debate about open borders, it's much easier to talk about that than it is to really, you know, share feelings about what's going on. And then another aspect they say is developing a different view of self. And this is exemplified by someone asked Thich Nhat Hanh what we need to do to save our world. He said, what we most need to do is to hear within us the sounds of the earth crying. So seeing ourselves as larger than just this, but interconnected with all of this. So then we feel this pain, even if it's someone else, even if it's far away. So in practicing with this, Macy and Johnstone have some neat practical practices that they suggest. These various meditations, kind of inviting yourself to reflect, perhaps journaling about it, if that helps you draw it out. Getting together with others to explore this, a little bit like we're doing now, but you know, in probably like smaller groups where more can be shared. Creative expression, so describe an exercise where you just kind of, you know, take some crayons or whatever and just kind of draw whatever comes out. Ceremony, they describe creating a personal cairn of, like, you know, you pick objects that reflect some issue of concern, and just, you know, some little place where you just kind of pile them up as your own little altar or something, which in some ways is what we've done up there. Being more honest in conversations. And then in terms of our Zen practice, I mean, Zazen is not about being calm. Zazen is not about trying to go into some thoughtless, emotionless space. Zazen is being real with your life. Right the way it is, right here and now. So, that kind of concern, that kind of tension, that kind of stress or longing or whatever can arise during Zazen if we don't try to turn away from it. Not that it's something that we then try to analyze or something, but it's acknowledging it. Like I said earlier, we have the dedication of merit. And in terms of use of ceremony, they're actually, this is a Kashita Garba service. So Kashita Garba or Jizo is a bodhisattva that the iconography and story, mythology, whatever of this bodhisattva is that he travels to hell to save beings from hell. And so this is, I got this from, it's a little bit adapted, I think, from Great Bao Zen Monastery. So basically there's, Kashita Garba or Jizo made this great vow. So Great Bao Zen Monastery is named after this bodhisattva. And so they do they chant a Dharani, there's a Jizo statue, and then somebody chants, at the time of his death, the Buddha said, I have worked hard for many kelpas to liberate obstinate living beings. And of course, this would be done, you know, we're all standing and someone would be chanting, those who have not yet understood the Dharma will surely fall into states of suffering. So this is the Buddha at his death saying there's still a lot of suffering beings. So Kashita Garba Bodhisattva said, even if their good deeds are as little as a hair, a drop of water, a grain of sand, a mote of dust, or a bit of down, I shall gradually help living beings to liberation. World-honored one, do not feel concerned over beings in generations to come. And then she or he repeated this vow 3 times. And then, so then there's a lot of chanting and bowing, infused with the great benevolence of Kashita Garba Bodhisattva, protector of all that is born from the earth, and this is responsive, so the doshi would be saying this, protector of all that is born from the earth, and then everybody's assembled, protector of all who is born from the earth, may I welcome everything that comes towards me with a warm and undefended heart, and then everybody does 3 full bows. Infused with the great determination of Kshita Garba Bodhisattva, protector of all that is born from the earth, may I walk the path to enlightenment, dissolving all obstructions and never turning back. And there's 3 bows. And then there's several more verses. And then this is the Kashita Garba vow. For as long as space endures and for as long as living beings remain. So then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. And that's repeated 3 times. So it's not quite the same thing as sitting in a circle and holding hands and dredging up our emotions hippie style, but it has its own power.
Tell me, what
is it? Omkaka kabisan. Omkaka kabisan mai soaka is the Jizo Dharan.
Right, but what does that translate?
It's as a Dharani, you don't really translate it. Sometimes people do translate Dharanis, but the idea is that for whatever it's worth, is that this is such an ancient, and actually back in India and probably still to this day, I mean there's a belief that sounds have power. Certain sounds have power in and of themselves. So this was a chant that had power. And then it was just transliterated into different languages. So it's not really words in that sense. So that series of syllables you chant over and over in order to invoke the strength of Jizo's vow. So I will just, before I open it up for a few questions, just end with a slightly positive note at the end of this chapter. She says, they say, there comes a point in many adventure stories when the main characters have seen the true nature of the crisis they face, and it is far worse than they previously imagined. It's not just their own lives that are at stake, but also a community they belong to, a value they cherish, a cause larger than themselves. With the limited tools and resources available to them, it might seem that they don't stand much of a chance. To have any hope at all, they need to step out into new ground in a quest to find new allies, understanding, and tools that will help. We will have moments when the penny really drops that our world is in grave danger. When facing a challenge far beyond what we might normally think ourselves capable of dealing with, we need to move beyond the familiar and learn the art of seeing with new eyes. The next section of this book introduces four empowering shifts in perception. We like to think of these as the four discoveries: a wider sense of self, a different kind of power, a richer experience of community, and a larger view of time. So that's what's coming. Any thoughts or comments?
I mean, well, we maybe have the opportunity to get in small groups and kind of talk about this, just an idea.
Yeah, I don't know when that would happen, or maybe it's something that we can just kind of put the invitation out for a particular time. If there was a time that like worked for you and those who were interested could come, maybe, I don't know, on Saturday or something. Or yeah, we could talk about that. If anybody else is interested, let me know. Were you thinking of like on a Tuesday breaking up into smaller groups, or
didn't have any particular
yeah.
in mind? I guess I thought on Tuesday, but another groups.
I think it's helpful to talk to others, especially I have a hard time, for instance, with the children in cages at the border, of dealing with passion and anger and frustration, and I want to yell at people, why aren't you out in the streets saying that this is just not acceptable, period? We're American. It is so awful on so many levels, and I'm trying to emulate you and be calm, but I'm having a very difficult time, and it's always supportive to talk to others who feel similar. Mm-hmm. I know, because if you talk to people that don't feel similar, you can just see their eyes glaze over and go, the woman is really crazy, just like you said. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe even smaller groups coming together can figure out effective ways, more effective ways, of letting their feelings
No, I don't know. Yeah, I think connecting with others is essential to this whole process. Unfortunately, we have a very strong tradition in Buddhism of saying Sangha is essential to our practice. And this is why I've struggled for a long time with a sense of, I mean, I know of a sangha just recently, so there was a big demonstration last week down at Fort Sill, where they aren't incarcerating children yet, but they're going to send them there, and that's where Native Americans were held, that's where Japanese were interned. I mean, it's just a place with a real bad, bad history. And so, you know, people were coming together, you know, never again. So they had the demonstration there. There were some people risking arrest, but then there were also Buddhist priests that did a ceremony. And so it was a very eclectic mix. So anyway, there was an email going out around the Buddhist circles about this, saying, you know, you might want to fold some paper cranes to send, or send your priest, or donate some money, or something like that. And so this sangha, like, somebody just thought, well, that's cool, and they sent that email out to the sangha email list, and, you know, they had someone, a board member, who said he wanted to resign because politics does not mix with sangha. And I mean, there are people, I probably aren't too many people here because I've always been a little outspoken about this stuff, but that is very troubling to me, because, like I said, I mean, people can make their own decisions about, you know, how much they should do, or are they doing enough, or whatever, but I need my sangha in this. I'm not going to do my sangha stuff here, and then I'll go off and do activist or whatever it is that I feel called to do over there. I mean, they're I can't separate them out like that. and I want to talk to my fellow sangha members about this stuff. Not, I mean, no offense intended, but a lot of the folks out there, even if they're well-meaning, don't have the same practice orientation that we do, don't have the same grounding in mindfulness and meditation and taking responsibility for your own reactions and that kind of stuff, which is like, I want to talk to people like that.
I recently saw a little book by the Dalai Lama on the importance of anger. Mm. And in this book, he talks about the difference between anger generated by greed and anger generated by compassion. Mm. And he's saying in this little booklet that we need our anger. It's very important to tap into our anger generated by compassion because of what's going on in the world, so that we can activate, use that anger generated by compassion to activate and energize change, not just sit back.
So are people finding this, so far, Act of Hope, what I've been presenting, been finding it helpful, interesting, or not?
I'm still in this chapter. Feeling kind of
bored
now.
Yeah.
And I like your idea, maybe another Saturday.
Yeah, or maybe, I mean, I feel like there's a lot to present in order to get this, what's in this book, across. But I don't know, maybe we do take some more time to break into smaller groups as well, to just, because, you know, it makes, whether you like it or not, it does make you get more engaged in the whole thing, rather than just, you know, sitting back and listening to me go on, so.
I mean, I feel kind of stifled in my life. My wife, I think she's at that spot where, you know, she knows in the back of her mind that this is going on, but she is as of yet unwilling to face it. So I can't really bring it up around her, and I guess I'm just looking for people who are willing to talk about it and eventually lead to some action.
Yeah. This has been my dream for a long time, was basically, and I mean, this is, people are different, but a lot of the people I know are very much like me in that our consciences are burdened, our hearts are heavy, we're concerned and worried, but what the hell do you do? I mean, you just, you know, you're in a, you're seeing the smoke billow under the door, nobody else is doing anything. I don't know, like, where do you go with it? What can you do? So it is. It's like being just kind of blocked and stuck, and so it's, I've considered it for quite a while now, just like we just got together and supported each other in that, you know, could we get past that block and do something? And I don't think any one of us has to do, no one of us is going to save the world, even if we wanted to try. But some small thing, I was just reading today, Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Martin Luther King. And he was making the case for civil disobedience, and he said he had encountered a 72-year-old lady who was, she was taking part in the bus boycott, and she had to walk a long way to and from work. And he asked her how she was, and she said, "My feet's hurt, but my soul is rested." And that's what I want. As long as we know that we are responding authentically, we're doing the best that we can, we're keeping in mind the world that we hope for. I mean, it's not, we won't be free of pain, because the pain is a natural response, but there's a part of our soul that could be at rest. That isn't, mine isn't yet. So, see if we can get there. Thank you all. Yeah.